You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Today, 8 of the 11 Supreme Judges upheld the judgment handed down by the High Court in November in a case that went to the very heart of our Constitution and how we are governed.
Following the failure of Britain's government to hear it the first time, Britain's Supreme Court confirms that Britain's Parliament will have to sign off on Britain's departure from the EU. My guests Mary Dejevsky and Phil Clark will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including...
We look forward to a genuine and constructive engagement by inclusive and empowered delegations, Syrian delegations, on all aspects of a political solution to this Syrian tragedy.
An agreement of sorts at the Syria peace talks in Kazakhstan, just not one that appears to involve any Syrians. As the exodus from South Sudan continues, why is Uganda one of the few countries which appears to regard incoming refugees as an opportunity? And in the Netherlands, Prime Minister Mark Rutte tries to outflank Geert Wilders by sounding more like Geert Wilders. Does this ever work? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Mary Dejevsky, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London. Welcome both, and we will begin here in Britain, where, not for the first time in recent months, the people who campaigned for years to restore the sovereignty of British courts and Britain's Parliament are incandescent with fury at British courts upholding the sovereignty of Britain's Parliament. The Supreme Court has rejected the government's appeal against an earlier decision and confirmed that Britain's exit from the European Union will require parliamentary approval. Gina Miller is the British businesswoman who has led the legal challenge. Let's hear first a little of what she had to say after today's verdict.
Today, 8 of the 11 Supreme Judges upheld the judgment handed down by the High Court in November in a case that went to the very heart of our Constitution and how we are governed. Only Parliament can grant rights to the British people, and only Parliament can take them away. No Prime Minister, no government can expect to be unanswerable or unchallenged. Parliament alone is sovereign. This ruling today means that MPs we have elected will rightfully have the opportunity to bring their invaluable experience and expertise to bear in helping the government select the best course in the forthcoming Brexit negotiations. Negotiations that will frame our place in the world and all our destinies to come.
Gina Miller speaking earlier. Mary, first of all, of the many things which I still fail to understand about this saga, why did the government appeal at all? Why not just suck it up, put a bill before Parliament after, or in fact, even before the original verdict? They've got the numbers.
Yes, and I think that they imagined in the first instance that it would have been so much easier for them to have a parliamentary vote and forget about invoking the royal prerogative and calling this a treaty and all the rest of it. It would have been much easier to go down that route in the first place. But I actually think they were probably right to appeal it right to the Supreme Court, because this is a rare instance of the United Kingdom having what is a real constitutional issue to argue out. And I think it was right that it went to the Supreme Court, and I think that decision was vindicated by the fact that it wasn't a unanimous verdict. When it went to the High Court, it sounded very much as though really it was a foregone conclusion that nobody could possibly disagree that there was a single view, and it was so obvious the government was wasting time and money taking it further. But I think the fact that the judgment went 8-3 and the three dissenting judges actually agreed on the point of their dissent I actually think that vindicates the process. I would add that the British Constitution is obviously a complete mess, that lots of things need to be clarified, including the role of Parliament vis-a-vis the sovereign, the monarch, and that it would be a big step to bring Britain into the modern age by actually having a proper written constitution like other people have. Given that we don't have that, I think it was right to take it to the Supreme Court.
One baffling, rancorous imbroglio at a time, I think. Phil, this now does bat it back into Parliament. The leader of the opposition, and I feel both the words both leader and opposition should be in inverted commas there, has essentially said that Labour will not stand in the way. But that being the case, what can slash should Parliament now do or to ameliorate, thwart, divert, review, advise, etc.?
I mean, this is where the opposition really should come into their own, because they've just been empowered by the courts.
You
might think that this is exactly their role, that this has been knocked back to Parliament. There will now have to be a parliamentary debate where all lines and aspects of this legislation will be debated. So if the Labour Party have, you know, things that they want incorporated into the Brexit agreement, then this is the moment to speak up about it. I mean, I guess this is another reason why I was also a little surprised that the government appealed this all the way to the Supreme Court, because it clearly plays into the government's hands to have to debate this in Parliament, because the opposition itself is much more divided on the Brexit question than the government itself is. And we're going to see the fractures in the Labour Party become even wider the longer this debate goes on. I mean, already we've seen 11 or 12 Labour MPs tell the press that they will probably vote against Article 50 because they come from very Remain-heavy constituencies, that they don't want to be selling out their own constituencies. So this is going to be yet again a very divisive issue for the opposition.
Mary, one victory of sorts for the government here was a unanimous judgment by the Supreme Court that they did not need to consult the devolved assemblies, by which we're talking about Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. Is this an effective calling, I guess, on the government's behalf of Nicola Sturgeon's bluff about a Scottish independence referendum?
Well, I rather think it is, and not just that, but the forthright way in which that particular part of the judgment was delivered. I mean, it stood out against everything else. It was like one or two sentences that said absolutely categorically that this was basically a decision for Parliament in London, that it was nothing to do with the devolved government. I think it's very difficult for Nicola Sturgeon, or indeed for whatever the next government in Northern Ireland is going to be, to start challenging this. But I think it could also prove to be extremely divisive, because if Theresa May, as Prime Minister, were to take that as a sort of mandate to cut them completely out of the process, then we're going to hear a lot more talk about a second referendum in Scotland, an independence referendum, and we're going to hear a lot more about difficulties between Northern Ireland and the border with the Republic. So I think that on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, there's maybe difficulties down the line.
Final thought on this one from you, Phil. Obviously, anybody who had been watching today's news and playing the will of the people drinking game is now in no fit state to be listening to us. But on that subject, what allowance should be made or can Parliament make for the possibility that 2, 3, 4, God knows how many years hence, that the UK actually leaves the EU, that it is for one reason or another no longer the actual will of the people for the process to go ahead?
This is one of the real paradoxes of this referendum, I think, that in many ways the will of the people that was expressed in the referendum was more powerful than the will of the people that is expressed through any general election, because at least with a general election, if the population thinks they made the wrong choice, they get a chance to undo that 4 years later. In the case of this referendum, there will be no second chance. This is happening now. There's a question over exactly what form it will take, but this is happening. So, you know, potentially the UK, perhaps not even 4 years down the track. I suspect even at the moment, many people who voted out at the referendum are having second thoughts about that and feel that the UK is going down a very dangerous pathway here. So this is the paradox of referendums like this.
Okay, well, let's move along. Now, at the outset of this week's Syrian peace talks in Astana, it did briefly look as if the negotiations themselves might necessitate the dispatch of peacekeepers, as both sides accused each other of assorted picturesque perfidies. Now, some agreement does appear appear to have been reached, but it appears to have been reached among the conference organisers, Russia, Turkey and Iran, who have announced that they will enforce, one way or another, the present rickety ceasefire. Mary, it is unclear, verging on clear, that they haven't, whether either the Syrian regime or the rebels have actually signed up to this. Is this conference best thought of as basically Russia, Turkey and Iran gathering everyone together in one room and telling them to knock it off?
Well, you could put it like that, and I think that's in some ways is actually quite an effective way of doing it. I also think that although, you know, it looks like the sort of three-cornered agreement which leaves out the other two, the actual warring parties, that this agreement may actually, even in its sort of preliminary embryonic form, maybe even if it's just about humanitarian corridors and ceasing fires and all the rest of it, I think that it has a better chance maybe than the previous ceasefires and preliminary agreements that were made between Russia and the United States. Because each of these three powers, first of all, has a direct interest in what happens next in Syria. Each of them has a degree of clout with the warring parties in a way that Russia had to an extent, but I don't think the Americans really did have to make that stick. And the other really important point is that, you know, what are called the facts on the ground now are quite different from how they were even 6 months ago, because eastern Aleppo has fallen. And while that may not be the end of the civil war, it sends a signal and it has reverberations across the rest of the country. And I think that it's quite difficult to see how, you know, what we used to call the moderate rebels are actually going to come back from that.
Phil, the communique that has been issued says that Russia, Turkey and Iran are all of the view that there's no military solution to the conflict. But I guess the question is not even, is that true? The question is, that's basically what has actually happened, hasn't it? I mean, and even if it hasn't entirely happened, what is the impetus at this point for Assad not to pursue a complete military victory? As Mary points out, with eastern Aleppo recaptured, the rebels have no major urban centres left in Syria anymore. They can't possibly see that there is a way back militarily.
No, indeed. And it's only because of that military campaign that we're at these talks to begin with. Furthermore, all of the parties that are supposedly mediating these talks are all actively involved in the military campaign at the moment. So while they may be saying this on paper, they're doing something entirely different in practice. I think Mary raises a really important point here, though, that with Iran, Russia and Turkey mediating these talks, you're looking at perhaps the only three major powers that have any clout in the Syrian situation. And this is going to build, I think, a really interesting contrast, a very important contrast with the UN's mediated talks in Geneva.
Which start next month.
Which start in about 2 weeks' time. And there's been talk that, you know, what's going on at Astana at the moment is supposed to be a building block towards Geneva. But in fact, I think there's a chance that these current talks could supersede that. This could become the process. One of the failures in Geneva seems to be that, in fact, all of the mediating parties, not least the UN, has no clout. It has no ability actually to force the parties on the ground to change their behaviour. So there's a very interesting contrast going on between two parallel peace processes.
Mary, that being the case, as we look ahead to those UN brokered talks in Geneva, which I believe start on February the 8th, do we have any idea yet what a potential political settlement could look like? Because as we've just been discussing, there doesn't appear, at least not to me, any particular reason why Assad at this point should concede anything. He has, to all intents and purposes, won, has he not?
Well, he's won, but he's won at the expense of control of bits of his territory. And so I think there will be quarrelling about who gets what and how far there is any sort of devolution. There will also be a question of what to do about the Kurds, because with Turkey at the table and one of the three powers negotiating, Turkey's priority in this, pretty much all along, right from the beginning, has been less anything to do with what happens in Damascus than to make sure that the Kurdish independent movement doesn't get traction from winning victories in northern Syria. And so I think, you know, you're looking at actually a more complicated situation on the periphery of Syria than maybe it looks from the talks in Astana.
Phil, looking at this from the point of view of the rebels represented in Astana, which obviously does not include Islamic State, who I don't think anybody is all that keen to negotiate with, even if such a thing were possible, which is a fairly debatable proposition in itself. Do they have any political leverage left at all? What are they in a position to insist upon as negotiations hopefully proceed starting in February?
At the very least, the rebel groups do seem to be able to use Turkey as a mouthpiece, given that Turkey's backing most of the 15 rebel groups in question. And also, you only had to look at the language of the sort of opening exchanges yesterday to get a sense that the rebels are pretty bolshy about their chances here. If this was supposed to be a peace process, it got off to a pretty rocky start with the rebels talking about the bloody despotic regime in Damascus and the Syrian government talking about these terrorists, pointing at the rebel groups. So, you know, the mediators have their work cut out for them here. But I think that the rebels realize they have very little sort of diplomatic maneuverability on their own terms. But their ability to kind of use Turkey and all of its various interests to kind of get their own way, I think, will be the avenue they'll take.
Final thought from you on this one, Mary. Do we as yet have the vaguest idea what a post-war Syria might look like? What the country, what sort of shape, possibly, you know, literally geographically, the country might be in 2-3 years from now, assuming that we are, well, assuming and hoping that this is the beginning of the end of the war?
If we were looking at this a year or 6 months ago, there was a lot of speculation that Syria was going to, if it wasn't going to break up, then it was going to be a very diminished form of Syria and that there would be border changes. I'm not sure that that is so at the moment. But when you talk about Assad being stronger and being able to win a complete military victory if he put his mind to it, that I don't think that's quite true. I think he's a bit weaker than that because he depended for the victory in Aleppo. He depended pretty much on Russian air power. And the Russians are not nearly as wedded to Assad's survival as Assad, rather than the survival of Syria as a state, than I think many people believe. So I think Assad is much more under Russia's thumb, and Russia is much less pro-Assad than a lot of people appreciate.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark. Coming up next, South Sudan's people continue to move next door.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark. And let's turn now to South Sudan, the world's youngest country, and for much of its brief existence, one of its most dangerous. Unsurprisingly, a hefty percentage of the fledgling nation's people, perhaps more than 1 in 10, have determined to take their chances elsewhere, whatever the cost and whatever the risk. Of the 1.3 million South Sudanese estimated to have fled, roughly half that number have descended upon Uganda, a country rarely touted as a human rights exemplar, and with good reason, but which maintains an extraordinarily compassionate policy towards refugees. Phil, first of all, it does seem askance with what Uganda is usually in the newspapers for on the human rights front, but they are remarkably accommodating in this respect.
That's true, and Uganda's had this very compassionate reputation towards refugees for decades. This isn't a recent phenomenon. I think part of the reason for that is that so much of the Ugandan population itself has been displaced over the last couple of decades. So there's a kind of sensibility in the country of what it's like to be, you know, forced beyond your borders. The other thing that has to be said about Uganda is that it's also quite an underpopulated country relative to many of its neighbours. So there's much more space there, and the Ugandan government have taken I guess, the viewpoint that refugees typically are an economic and political asset, that actually we've seen a lot of business and a lot of economic activity in Uganda for 20 or 30 years now generated out of these very vibrant refugee camps. So the government tends to see them as an asset rather than a burden.
Mary, is Uganda and / South Sudan a special case, or is there something here that Europe can or should learn from?
I think that it's not a special case if you look at these sort of things globally, because I think it's always pointed out when Europe starts complaining about the number of refugees coming in their direction, then it's pointed out that actually the vast majority of refugees are actually nowhere near Europe. They're much more closer to the countries that they originated from, and they are not looking to, as it were, to better themselves hugely by coming to Europe. But I do think there is quite a distinction between, let's say, South Sudanese, Eritrean, sub-Saharan African refugees making their way via Libya to Italy and up through to Northern Europe. And, you know, often people who talk about the refugees in Europe sympathetically say, isn't it tragic that Europe has become so much less generous than it was, say, in 1945? Why are people so hard-hearted? Why aren't people opening their arms, opening their homes and saying, you know, everybody come? And I think there's two points to be made here. One of them is actually an extension of the point that Phil made, that Uganda has its recent experience of its own displacement. And you can take that direct to what was going on 45, 47 in Europe. Lots of people were displaced. The other thing relates to standards of living, that in Europe immediately after the war, and in Uganda, South Sudan now, living standards are, if not very similar, then maybe one or two steps removed. The living standards and just the way of operating and behaving and earning money and social structures and rule of law, all those things, people who are coming from, say, sub-Saharan Africa, South Sudan, if they're making their way all the way to Europe, the culture clash, the gap, is gigantic.
Phil, looking at South Sudan itself and the situation there, it's bad, and there have been warnings that it could get much worse. Ban Ki-moon, the outgoing UN Secretary General, warned last year of potential looming genocide. Is there any case for action either by African countries or by the wider world to dissuade South Sudanese from leaving, by which I mean intervening actively to try and solve the problem?
To a large extent, that's already happened. We've had an AU intervention, which, if anything, just stirred the pot and increased the refugee flows even more. The Ugandan government itself had forces in South Sudan for 18 months there, and arguably was part of the problem as well. So kind of military solutions to what's happening in South Sudan have been used and have failed thus far. The other part of this picture, I think, in terms of refugees, just to kind of fill the picture out a little bit, is that, I mean, the Ugandan government also sees a very direct international interest in hosting refugees from South Sudan and elsewhere, which is that it also then receives a huge amount of funding from UNHCR and other international bodies. Politically, various African governments also use the hosting of refugees as leverage, so that if they're criticized by outside actors, if they're pressured militarily, they're able to say, well, what we'll do is we'll close the refugee camps. We've seen Kenya do this with the Big Dadaab camp just across the border from Somalia. Uganda in the past has made similar threats about some of its refugee camps as well. So it's also, apart from compassion, it's also good old-fashioned realpolitik.
Okay, well, finally tonight, an imminent indication of whether 2017 will prove as seismic and or awful as its predecessor looms on March 15th when the Netherlands votes for a new parliament. This is predicted to go well for Freedom Party leader Geert Wilders, who hopes that the current trend for electing petty, mean-spirited nativists with silly hair persists until at least then. In a transparently obvious bid to forestall him, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has suggested that anyone who doesn't subscribe to the country's great liberal tradition should perhaps go elsewhere. Mary, the quote attributed to Mark Rutte in English-speaking news coverage, act normal or go away, might lose something in translation, but I think we know what he's saying. Is this a sensible strategy on his part?
Well, I think that on first acquaintance, a lot of people will have a great deal of sympathy for the sentiment behind his words, whatever they actually were in Dutch, because you can quite understand that as I read the rest of what he said, he was basically saying, this is absolutely fine. You can behave differently. You can dress how you want to dress. But when you start telling us how to behave, that's when maybe you should start thinking of going elsewhere. And I think there would probably be a lot of sympathy for that. As far as a strategy for winning an election, I actually don't think it is, because I think that the moment the centre-right parties or centre or right parties start to go further right, they're immediately outdone by the real far right. And the number of votes that they're likely to get from people who are maybe have too many inhibitions about voting for the far right, I think those votes are likely to be kept by the centre right anyway. So it seems like a sort of gratuitous thing to do. It's also, I think, true, and you know, this may be proved spectacularly wrong in whatever it is, 6 weeks' time or so. But we did see a similar sort of interplay of forces in Austria with the presidential election, and the far right was rejected. And I think maybe sometimes because the far right is so, it's so one of a kind, and it's so in some ways easy to report because it sits out there separate, maybe just a little bit we exaggerate the sympathy it gets.
Phil, is the Netherlands a special case in this respect? Because there is a modern history, of course, there of multiculturalism being challenged from the left, thinking of characters like Pim Fortuyn, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, etc. Are we thinking of this the right way if we actually think of Wilders as a creature of the far right?
No, I think there might be some truth to that. I think especially this sort of Islamophobic sentiment is much more widespread through the Netherlands than just people who would vote for Wilders' party. I think that's true. But that said, Rutte's government has been pretty moderate on this issue for the duration of their time in power. They've been, you know, quite open about the need for tolerance. They've made some very important sort of public statements about embracing Islam. So, I mean, I think also this is why the people who will vote for Wilders' party won't be convinced by the things they hear coming out of Rutte's mouth, because he's said completely the opposite things over the last year or two. But I think this is a classic trend, and we're seeing this right across Europe at the moment. Parties that have typically had quite what I would think is a fairly sensible multicultural policy are being dragged increasingly to the right, which I think is ethically repugnant and probably also won't win them elections. So it's a terrible strategy. At the moment, I have to say, for all of his lack of leadership, one of the few sort of political elites in Europe that hasn't, you know, sort of gone down this anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim pathway is Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party here. Even Merkel, you know, who's been this kind of champion of refugees and asylum seekers and multiculturalism, has had to do some dog whistling on the right recently. Corbyn and the Labour Party are sort of on their own here.
Mary, though, just as probably a final thought on this, as we're running out of time, is there fundamentally anything wrong with a country sort of declaring basically this is what we do here, this is what we stand for, there are certain irreducible fundamentals which you may not find to your taste, and in which case you might be better off trying your luck somewhere else?
Well, I'm quite a lot less liberal on the migration and cultural questions than a lot of people would probably expect of somebody with my sort of otherwise liberal political views. I do think there is a problem here. But I also think there is a related problem, which is often people find themselves talking in these terms about people who have not actually come into the country. And that would apply to the Netherlands just as it applies to Britain or to France. These are second generation and third generation whose families have either failed to integrate or who are expressing themselves by trying to return to their cultural roots. And that's, I think, a rather different problem.
Mary Dejewski and Phil Clark, we will have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Stephen Kenny and Elisa Mayer, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, 1900 at Section D with Josh Fennett, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200 London time. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.